Mister was nowhere to be seen when I got home, but I left the food in his dish anyway. He would eventually forgive me for my getting home late. I collected the things that I would need from my kitchen, fresh-baked bread with no preservatives, honey, milk, a fresh apple, a sharp silver penknife, a tiny dinner set of a plate, bowl, and cup that I had carved myself from a block of teak wood. I went back out to my car. The Beetle isn't really blue anymore, since both doors have been replaced, one with the green clone and one with the white one, and the hood of the storage trunk in front had to be replaced with a red duplicate, but the name stuck anyway. Mike is a super mechanic. He never asked questions about the burns that slagged a hole in the front hatch or the claw marks that ruined both doors. You can't pay for service like that. I revved up the Beetle and drove down I-94 around the shore of Lake Michigan, crossing through Indiana briefly and then crossing over the state line into Michigan itself. Lake Providence is an expensive, high-class community with big houses and sprawling estates. It isn't cheap to own land there. Victor Sells must have been doing well in his former position at Silver Co. to afford a place out that way. The lakeshore drive wound in and out among thick, tall trees and rolling hills down to the shore. The properties were well spread out, several hundred yards between them. Most of them were fenced and had gates on the right side of the road, away from the lake as I drove north. The Sells house was the only one I saw on the lake side of the drive. A smooth gravel lane lined by trees led back from the lakeshore drive to the Sells house. A peninsula jutted out onto the lake, leaving enough room for the house and a small dock at which no boats were moored. The house was not a large one by the standards of the rest of the Lake Providence community. Built on two levels, it was a very modern dwelling. A lot of glass and wood that was made to look like something more synthetic than wood by the way it had been smoothed and cut and polished. A drive curved around the back of the house, where a driveway big enough to host a 5-on-5 game of basketball around a backboard erected to one side was overlooked by a wooden deck leading off to the second level of the house. I drove the Blue Beetle around to the back of the house and parked there. My ingredients were in a black nylon backpack, and I picked that up and brought it with me as I got out of the car and stretched my legs. The breeze coming upslope from the lake was cool enough to make me shiver a little, and I drew my mantle duster closed across my belly. My first impressions are important, and I wanted to listen to what my instincts said about the house. I stopped for a long moment and just stared at it. My instincts must have been holding out for another bottle of Max Ale. They had little to say, other than that the place looked like a pricey little dwelling that had hosted a family through many a vacation weekend. Well, where my instincts fail, intellect must venture. Almost everything was fairly new. The grass around the house had not grown long enough this winter to require cutting. The basketball net was stretched out and loose enough to show that it had been used fairly often. The curtains were all drawn. On the grass behind the deck, something red gleamed, and I went beneath the deck to retrieve it. It was a plastic film canister, red with a gray cap, the kind you keep on a roll of film in when you send it to the processors. Film canisters were good for holding various ingredients I used sometimes. I tucked it in my duster pocket and continued my inspection. The place didn't look like a family dwelling, really. It looked like a rich man's love nest, a secluded little getaway nestled back in the trees of a peninsula and safe from spying eyes. Or an ideal location for a novice sorcerer to come out and try his fledgling abilities safe from interruptions. A good place for Victor Sells to set up shop and practice. I made a quick circuit of the house, tried the front and rear doors, and even the door up on the deck that led presumably to the kitchen. All were locked. Locks weren't really an obstacle, but Monica Sells hadn't invited me to actually take a look inside the house, just around it. It's bad juju to go tromping into people's houses uninvited. One of the reasons vampires as a rule don't do it, they have enough trouble just holding themselves together outside of the Never Never. It isn't harmful to a human wizard like me, but it can really impair anything you try to do with magic. Also, it just isn't polite. Like I said, I'm an old-fashioned sort of guy. Of course, the Tektronix Securities control panel that I could see through the front window had some say in my decision. Not that I couldn't hex it down to a useless bundle of plastic and wires, But a lot of security systems will cause an alarm with their contact company if they abruptly stop working without notice. It would be a useless exercise. In any case, the real information was to be had elsewhere. Still, something nagged me. Sense of not quite emptiness to the house. On a hunch, I knocked on the front door several times. I even rang the bell. No one came to answer the door, and no lights were on inside. I shrugged and walked back to the rear of the house, passing a number of empty trash cans as I did. Now, that was a bit odd. I mean, I would expect a little something in the trash, even if someone hadn't been there in a while. Did the garbage man come all the way down the drive to pick up the trash cans? That didn't seem likely. If the Sellses had come out to the house for a weekend and wanted the trash emptied, it would stand to reason that they would have had to leave it out by the drive near the road as they left, which would seem to imply that the garbage men would leave the empty trash cans out by the road. Someone must have brought them back to the house. Of course, it needn't have been Victor Sells. It could have been a neighbor or something. Or maybe he tipped the garbage men to carry the cans back away from the road. But it was something to go on. A little hint that maybe the house hadn't been empty all week. I left the house behind me and walked towards the lake. The night was breezy but clear and a bit cold. The tall old trees creaked and groaned beneath the wind. It was still early for the mosquitoes to be too bad. The moon was waxing towards full overhead, with the occasional cloud slipping past her like a gauzy veil. It was a perfect night for catching fairies. I swept an area of dirt not far from the lake shore, clear of leaves and sticks, and took the silver knife from the backpack. Using the handle, I drew a circle in the earth, then covered it up with leaves and sticks again, marking the location of the circle's perimeter in my head. I was careful to focus in concentration on the circle, without actually letting my power slip into it and spoil the trap. Then, working carefully, I prepared the bait by setting out a little cup and bowl. I poured a thimbleful of milk into the cup and dabbed the bowl full of honey from the little plastic bear in my backpack. Then I tore a little piece of bread from the loaf I brought with me and pricked my thumb with a knife. In the silver light of the moon, the bit of dark blood welled up against the skin, and I touched it dainty to the underside of the coarse bread, letting it absorb the blood. Then I set the bread, bloody side down, on the tiny plate. My trap was set. I gathered up my equipment and retreated to the cover of the trees. There are two parts of magic you have to understand to catch a fairy. One of them is the concept of true names. Everything in the whole world has its own name. Names are unique sounds and cadences of words that are attached to one specific individual, sort of like a theme music. If you know something's name, you can associate yourself with it in a magical sense, almost in the same way a wizard can reach out and touch someone if he possesses a lock of their hair or fingernail clippings or blood. If you know something's name, you can create a magical link to it, just as you can call someone up to talk to them if you know their phone number. Just knowing the name isn't good enough, though. You have to know exactly how to inflect and say it. Ask two John Franklin Smiths to say their name for you, and you'll get subtle differences in the tone and pronunciation, each one unique to its owner. Wizards tend to collect names of creatures, spirits, and people like some kind of huge Rolodex. You never know when it'll come in handy. The other part of magic you need to know is the magic circle theory. Most magic involves a circle of one kind or another. Drawing a circle sets a local limit on what a wizard is trying to do. It helps him refine his magic, focus and direct it more clearly. It does this by creating a sort of screen, defined by a perimeter of the circle that keeps random magical energy from going past it, containing it within the circle so that it can be used. To make a circle, you draw it out on the ground or close hands with a bunch of people or walk about spreading incense, or any number of other methods, while focusing on your purpose in drawing it. Then you invest it with a little spark of energy to close the circuit, and it's ready. One other thing such a circle does, it keeps magical creatures like fairies, or even demons, from getting past it. Neat, huh? Usually this is used to keep them out. It's a bit trickier to set up a circle to keep them in. That's where the blood comes into play. With blood comes power. If you take in some of someone else's blood, there's a metaphysical significance to it, a sort of energy. It's minuscule if you aren't really trying to get energy that way, the way vampires do, but it's enough to close a circle. Now you know how it's done, but I wouldn't recommend you try it at home. You don't know what to do when something goes wrong. I retreated to the trees and called the name of the particular fairy I wanted. It was a rolling series of syllables, quite beautiful, really, especially since the fairy went by the name of Toot Toot every time I encountered him before. I pushed my will out along with the name, just made it a call, something that would be subtle enough to make him wander this way of his own accord. Or at least that was my theory. What was his name? Please. You think wizards just give information like that away? You don't know what I went through to get it. About 10 minutes later, Toot came flickering in over the water of Lake Michigan. At first I mistook him for a reflection of moon on the side of the softly rolling waves of the lake. Toot was maybe 6 inches tall. He had silvery dragonfly's wings sprouting from his back, and the pale, beautiful, tiny humanoid form that echoed the splendor of the Fey Lords. A silver nimbus of ambient light surrounded him. His hair was a shaggy, silken little mane, like a bird of paradise's plumes, and was a pale magenta. Toot loved bread and milk and honey, a common vice of the lesser fae. They aren't usually willing to take on the nest of bees to get to the honey, and there's been a real dearth of milk in the Never Never since high-tech dairy farms took over most of the industry. Needless to say, they don't grow their own wheat, harvest it, thresh it, and then mill it into flour to make bread either. Toot alighted on the ground with caution, scanning around the trees. He didn't see me. I saw him wipe his mouth and walk in a slow circle around the miniature dining set, one hand rubbing greedily at his stomach. Once he took the bread and closed the circle, I'd be able to bargain information for his release.